In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
And now, Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for another Coolest Conversations on Little Steven's Underground Garage, presented by Hard Rock. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening. And please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. We've got a very special chat lined up for you today, as it's with Colin Blunstone, lead singer in the 60s British invasion band The Zombies. They had several noteworthy top 10 hits, including She's Not There, Tell Her No, and Time of the Season. The latter is from their seminal album Odyssey and Oracle, which the band remastered and reissued last year in glorious mono. And this year, they've applied the same process to their debut album, Begin Here. We'll give a listen to a little bit of one of its tunes, It's All Right With Me, and that'll be followed by my Talk with Colin on your Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage. You're back with the Mighty Manfred and Little Steven's Underground Garage, and joining me for a very special Coolest Conversations today is Colin Blunstone, best known for being the lead singer in The Zombies. Back in the 60s, they had three top 10 hits with She's Not There, Tell Her No, and Time of the Season, the latter off their seminal album Odyssey and Oracle, which was remastered and released, reissued last year in glorious mono, and now this year saw the release 2 weeks back of their debut album Begin Here, also in its original glorious mono incarnation. How are you, Colin?
I'm fine, Manfred. It's great to see you. Always good to have a chat.
Yes, good to see you again, my friend. Congratulations on the release of your debut album, reissue of the debut album.
Thank you very much. I mean, it's so thrilling that there is so much interest in The Zombies in 2026. When the band actually finished in 1967. And I think I can speak for all of us in saying that The Zombies felt that was it. It was very sad, but we felt The Zombies had run their course. And so it's been incredible that the interest should have revived, 50 or 60 years, and here we are. And there's two albums, as you just said, Odyssey and Oracle and Begin Here, which have just been released. And there are two more albums to come in the next few months. So look out for those. But right now, Begin Here is the focal point.
Yes. Oh, so it came out, I was looking this up, the original version of the album when it came out originally in the 60s. Okay. April 65 in the UK, came out in the US a little bit before that. And I'm guessing it did only because maybe because She's Not There, such a even a bigger hit in the U.S. than it was in the U.K.
Yeah.
Now, the U.S. version has three extra songs that weren't on the U.K. version. That wasn't strange. That was quite normal for the era. There'd be the U.K. version, U.S. versions would have sometimes different track orders. Let's see, thinking about this now, my first question is, Why reissue the album? You reissued Odyssey and Oracle. You're just going through the catalog, or what was the thought about going back to Begin Here? Why Begin Here?
Well, I think there are lots of reasons, really. But we've just formed a new record company, Beechwood Park Records. The rights to the records have reverted to us, and we can now issue this through our own label. For the first time, the UK album and the US album, as you said, they had different track listings. All the tracks are on this album. And also, it became hard to find this album in its original mono version. The stereo didn't exist, as far as I can remember. We were never asked to do a stereo version. But I know that staff producers at Decca, we recorded for Decca in West Hampstead in London, staff producers were doing stereo mixes. We weren't in the studio, we weren't consulted. And so I think that some of the impact of this album started to be lost, really, because many people were attempting remixes on the tracks. So I think it's a good thing to just set the story straight. This is what these tracks, as you hear them, this is what we heard when the album was being recorded in probably late 1964 or early 1965.
And so when these tracks were originally recorded, this is how you wanted them presented?
Well, that's a long story anyway, because we had a very autocratic producer called Ken Jones. And although to a large extent, obviously, Rod Argent and Chris White wrote most of the songs, Rod usually arranged the songs. But when it came to mixing, you know, so we've recorded it, now we're going to mix it, the final thing that everyone will hear, he would never let us attend the mix sessions. And it got very, very tense at times, big, aggressive shout-ups in the studio about whether we could attend the mix or not. And I think that in the end, that was the breaking point with our relationship with him. And of course, we went on and recorded Odyssey and Oracle at Abbey Road rather than at Decca. They're very close, these studios, or they were. Decca doesn't exist anymore. With Rod Argent and Chris White in the producers' chairs. And I think they did a wonderful job. But until then, it had always been Ken Jones producing. And it wasn't always as we heard it, I have to say. We would be asked to sort of go and have a meal somewhere or something and then come back and hear the track finished. And there were times when I walked in. I can remember one, it's not on this album, but I don't think. But there's a song called Is This a Dream? It was a slightly obscure single. And when we left, I thought it sounded really meaty and rocking and pretty good. Went and had a couple of beers with Rod at the pub at the top of the road and came back and he played me the track. I didn't understand what I was listening to. I actually thought, which is completely illogical, a thought crossed my mind, he's got someone to cover what we did. There's another band that's covered it. It sounded so unlike what we left him with. So there definitely was a problem in the mixing area.
Well, about that, so you would... You couldn't attend the mixes. When you came back, was there any opportunity to say, oh, this sounds, you know, this is kind of in the ballpark of what we're thinking, Ken, but could you change this or that? Or it was like, here's what it is, lads, suck it up.
Yeah. This is it, guys. What's next? Are we doing another track? What's happening? In a nice way. I mean, this guy was not an unpleasant person. He was very, very nice. But he had a very set, he was older than us, more experienced than us. Remember, for instance, recording She's Not There, It's All Right With Me, Summertime, and You Make Me Feel Good on the first session. Rod and I were 18, and we knew nothing about the music business. Paul Atkinson was 17. And so Ken Jones was an experienced figure in the music business, and he didn't like contributions, or probably he saw it as interference in the mixing sessions. And so we couldn't, I suppose we could comment, but it certainly wasn't appreciated.
In fact, recording those tracks, let's think, comes up, I mentioned April 65, the previous year in June, you recorded She's Not There. November of 64, you did Tell Her No. The balance of the songs that are on the album, did you have to like go in the studio and do a whole bunch of tracks all at once? Or was it a short span of time, like you had a couple of days to knock out the whole album, or did you have a couple of weeks? How rushed was the recording process for the album?
It was fairly rushed. I mean, obviously, it's a long time ago, so in some to be specific, but my feeling is that Decca, She's Not There took Decca and us, I hasten to add, by surprise, because it was an immediate hit in the UK and pretty much an immediate hit in the States as well. And Deckard didn't really know what to do. And they were straight away onto us for extra tracks. First of all, for another quick single, and then eventually for an album. And we were slightly stuck because Rod Argent wrote She's Not There, Chris White wrote the B-side, but they hadn't got a back catalogue of songs. They just started writing. So, for instance, when Decca put the pressure on for a follow-up single, we only had one track that was available, and it was a song called Leave Me Be, when none of us thought it was an A-side. None of us thought it stood a chance, but Decca insisted on releasing it. And, you know, our career could have been over there and then. I think that we felt they knew what they were talking about. With the benefit of hindsight, I don't think they got a clue. It almost seems as though they did everything they could to end our career in a very early date. So with this album, I remember there being a lot of pressure. I'm sure the other guys feel the same way. And we had this problem that Rod and Chris hadn't written a lot of songs. They were trying to write songs, but we were touring all the time. So they were literally in the back of the bus with a couple of guitars trying to write songs. And it meant that we had to sort of magic up some tracks. Before She's Not There, we'd been playing a lot of just local gigs. Rod and Chris hadn't written any songs for these gigs. And although we had delved into the rhythm and blues repertoire of the time, at one time the Zombies were called the Zombies R&B, because that's what we played. But with the Beatles sort of taking over to such an extent, we were such huge fans, we'd actually started playing quite a few Beatles tunes. There's no way we can do a cover of Beatles songs on a Zombies album. And so a lot of the songs that we were playing live wouldn't be appropriate for a Zombies album.
What were some of these Beatles songs that you were playing? Do you recall?
I can remember some. We did Just 17. We did Money. We did, do you remember a song called Misery?
Oh, yeah.
We did that with a very strange intro. Chris White was quite into, stage appearance and dressing up the stage act. And I think he had us wearing boater hats. Do you know what those not bowler, boater, they're woven hats. It's like the boys at Eton wear in the summer. They wear these hats. It was a very strange look, but he was convinced. I think, as I remember, I think the others had to say, I say, I say, I say. And I had to say, oh, what do you say? And then we're going, the world is treating me bad. It was something like that. Absolutely appalling in the middle of a rock and roll set. I don't think I thought it was appropriate even at the time. But thinking about it now, it's absolutely dreadful. But so that was that song, Misery. I'm sure there were other ones that we tried as well.
One last thing I was going to ask you about Ken Jones, and you already spoke to him, but on the album there is a track, an instrumental track that's credited to him called Work and Play.
Yes.
And I was wondering, is that something that was just like a studio jam that kind of came together, or was it something he actually said, oh, I've mapped this out, I want you guys to do this song?
It was something along those lines. From memory, he said, you know, every album needs an instrumental, and I just happened to have one here. And again, we were very naive, I think, and just got on with it. Obviously, I didn't contribute to the instrumental, and Ken wrote it and got a writing credit on the album.
Well,
show business, kid. That's show business.
That's it. I was going to say, when my comment about you thought the music, the guys, you know, knew what they were doing in the record company, and I guess that's just part of the music business too. That none of these people know really what they're doing, you know.
They certainly didn't then, because I think rock and roll music, and in particular what we would probably call now the British invasion, had mystified everyone on both sides of the Atlantic. They had no idea what was going on, and it would have been better. I think a lot of the top executives did admit it, you know, instead of just get on with it. I don't understand what's happening. But some of the guys lower down the food chain would try and tell you that they did know what was going on, and usually made a complete mess of it, and certainly with regard to the zombies. The zombies in the UK had been so badly promoted in the first few months, I don't think we ever recovered. And hence, I think we were always a little bit more successful in America than we were in the UK, because we'd just been promoted in such a bad way. Awful, embarrassing.
Well, I want to touch a moment more on the blues R&B thing, because on the album you cover Bo Diddley's Roadrunner, Muddy Waters, I Got My Mojo Working, The Miracles, You Really Got a Hold on Me, Ray Charles's Sticks and Stones, Solomon Burke's Can't Nobody Love You. What a great playlist there. Can you speak a moment about the importance of American blues and R&B on the whole British music scene at the time?
Oh, absolutely. All the bands were absolutely in awe of all the great blues and rhythm and blues and the greats of rock and roll. And all the British bands just were dying to go to America to try and witness some of this music and hopefully meet some of these people. And I can tell you that personally, sometimes in America when I was on stage, I know this might sound a bit weird, but I felt a little bit embarrassing because we would be playing perhaps some of those songs, You Really Got a Hold on Me, or Roadrunner, or something like that. I wanted to say to the audience, because obviously with the British invasion, the audiences were wild. You know, they were, you know, it was like a riot. And I wanted to say to them, this is your music we're playing. It's been through a sort of a UK filter, but it's your music. We idolise your artists. You know, I don't think any British artists were ever trying to take over the American market. We were in awe of American artists.
When you were performing, you mentioned touring around in the UK. Was there a camaraderie amongst the bands at that point? Were people more standoffish when you go and play gigs? Or how often did you play with other bands?
Well, you know, I think it varied. There were some bands were very friendly, but some bands were quite standoffish, quite, as I remember, quite sort of tough. You know, they had a bit of an edge to them. It depended on the circumstances. One of the first things we did one of these package tours where you would have, in the UK, 7 or 8 artists traveling around together. So we had the Searchers, who were a huge band at that time, topping the bill, Dionne Warwick and the Isley Brothers. And then there were 3 or 4 other bands as well. And there was quite a bit of camaraderie in that tour, because for the most part, we were traveling together anyway. So there was plenty of time to get to know one another. After that, with other bands, often the Zombies would be headlining, and often we'd play on our own. So there wasn't much going on backstage, but it varied from band to band. Some were friendly, some very definitely were not. So, I mean, I think that from those early days, I've often thought about this. I think sometimes people might think I'm standoffish, but I'm not. I like backstage, I'm more comfortable if people come and talk to me. I'm happy to talk to anyone about anything. But I've had one or two situations where I've bounded up to a band probably that I've admired for years and you know, got the cold shoulder. So it's kind of put me off that side of things a little bit. But anybody that wants to have a chat, I'm up for it, absolutely.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about Rod and Chris's relationship. So Rod Argent, he wrote the several big hits, She's Not There, Tell Her No, Time of the Season. For every A-side that he wrote, most of the time, not always, but most of the time, there's a Chris White song on the B-side. And then after you guys had ended there towards the end of the 60s, Rod and Chris continued to work together, and they worked together on your solo career even. Can you tell us something about the relationship between those two guys? And like, for instance, was Chris ever treated as a junior partner, or did they have sort of an equitable relationship?
No, I think I've always thought that the cornerstone of the Zombies was Rod Argent. And as musicians, the rest of us were okay You know, we were all right. But Rod was special. You know, he was world class. I don't think he's really ever got the acclaim that he deserves. He can play anything. If you ever check out Rod Argent's album, Classically Speaking, it's breathtakingly good. And he's playing classical pieces. I've seen him play jazz with great jazz players, and he's equally at home there. And he's a great rock and roll musician as well. And yeah, he's just a superb world-class keyboard player. So there always was that. The Zombies was Rod's band. It was his idea. He wrote many of the songs, although he was very happy to work on Chris's songs. And sometimes he helped Chris with his songs. And at this time, the credits were separate. Later on, they wrote and the credits were together. It was Argent White. But at this time, so he was helping Chris with his songs, not always, but sometimes. And but it was still just a Chris White song. So I think they admired one another as writers. They shared a flat that with a third guy, Terry Quirk, who did the artwork on Odyssey and Oracle and famously spelt Odyssey incorrectly. The three of them shared a flat. So, I mean, they were very good friends. And I think they worked very well as writers. I think Rod, from the beginning, was writing really, I mean, She's Not There is an all-time classic song. But by the time we got to Odyssey and Oracle, from memory, I think Chris wrote 7 tracks to Rod's 6. He certainly wrote more than Rod did. And every track on that album is a gem. And Chris had just blossomed as a writer. He was just an incredible writer, just learning his craft through the 3 years beforehand.
Well, let me ask you about a Rod song specifically. It's one of the highlights of the album, The Way I Feel Inside. And it's, you know, you start off a cappella, then Rod comes in with this with the organ, and it just has this wonderful sort of fragileness, stripped down nature that sort of lends itself to this raw sort of emotional honesty that the song is revealing. And juxtaposed to that is the way he wrote the song, right? He was on the toilet when he wrote the song.
Well, he certainly finished the song on the toilet. I mean, he remembers it slightly different to me. I think we both remember him being on the toilet. But what I remember was we were on that package tour with The Searchers, Dionne Warwick and Isley Brothers, and we'd left the gear in this theatre and gone to the hotel, and we went back in the morning to pick up the gear. And Rodman shut himself away in the smallest room in the theatre, and he was writing a manuscript, actually writing literally the whole thing, and he forgot about time. This is as I remember it. I don't think Rod remembers it this way. But we got down to the bus and everybody's waiting to go. Well, where's Rod? And we're all searching for him. And I found him by looking under the door of one of the cubicles. I could see him sitting there writing The Way I Feel Inside, which is quite kind of appropriate, really.
Would you have any idea about what was his inspiration for that? Because it is such a powerful song, and you know, just in your delivery and everything, it's just
Honestly, I don't know. The Rod's inspirations are not always obvious, and I've never asked him about that. I can tell you that we recorded it live. It's one take. I think we might have had 3 or 4 goes at it, but that is one take of I just sang and then Rod came in at the end. It's not patched or tuned or anything. It is a bit of a tricky one to do live. We went to the Philippines and that song was a big hit in the Philippines, and we were playing huge concerts there in an arena. You know, we opened to 28,000 people. It's a story all of its own. And they wanted all different songs. They'd for instance, The Way I Feel Inside. And I sang it regularly in front of these huge audiences. And one night, I slightly drifted out of pitch because I'm not singing to anything. I'm just singing to myself. It's very easy to drift if you're not careful. And when Rod came in, it took me so by surprise. I didn't know what was going on. We didn't have in ears, so I'm just trying to listen to him on the other side of the stage, and we're in a great big arena. And he came in, and we weren't in tune. And so after that, Rod always ghosted it. He's not sort of playing the melody, but he would play a few chords just to hold the whole thing together. Because it was tricky in those days. There were no on-stage monitors, no in-ear monitors, and a lot of what we did, well, that was a particularly tricky song, but a lot of what we did was three-part harmony, and we can't really hear what the other person's doing. So you've got to try and stay in tune yourself and hope for the best.
You and Rod reformed the Zombies in the early 2000s, and you were active up until his stroke in July of 2024. How is Rod doing?
He's doing really well. I was speaking to him earlier today. He's written a new song, which he's very keen on, and I live very close to him. I went to rehearse that song with him last week, and I'm going on Friday to do it again. I'm going to do a tour for the whole of May, and at the end of May, we're going to record a new Rod Argent song, and then we'll see what happens. Rod is adamant he's not going to tour anymore, but I think he would like to keep writing. I know he would like to keep writing and recording, so we'll see what happens. This is the first song, and a lot of the guys from the newer version of the Zombies are going to turn up, you know, definitely want to be in the studio to play on that track. So it's going to be exciting and it's going to be fun.
So you mentioned you're playing out this next month. I think the tour is called Colin Blundstone Believe in Miracles Solo Tour, playing around the UK. And the backing band in that, is that the members of the Latter-day Zombies backing you?
Or is it's two of them. It's 50-50. Soren Koch is playing guitar. He played bass in the Zombies. Steve Roth was playing drums. He was the drummer in the Zombies. And then there are two guys who I knew separately and completely forgot that they were both in the Straubs. So Chas Kronk is playing bass, who was in the Straubs, and Dave Bainbridge is playing keyboards, who was in the Straubs. And it was very embarrassing because I knew them both separately. And then when we got together for the first rehearsal, I tried to introduce them. we were in the Straubs for years, so you don't need to bother introducing us, which was a little bit embarrassing.
So the reissued album's title, Begin Here, there's also, let's talk a moment about this Begin Here festival. It's over Halloween weekend this year, the 30th, October 30th through November the 1st. I see it billed as being an opportunity for people to spend time with original members of the Zombies. It's there in the hometown, St. Albans. Things include a candlelight concert, singing sessions, dance parties, master classes. Is this the first of these festivals, or have you had?
No, it's the third. It's the third, actually. It's a time to celebrate all things Zombies, really. There are lots of people who will give talks. I know that at this particular festival, the very first bass player in the Zombies, before we ever made She's Not There, the only guy we ever allowed to leave the Zombies was a guy called Paul Arnold. And he became a doctor, and he ended up living in Edmonton in Canada. And he's going to come over and give a talk. He's never, ever given a talk about anything to do with the Zombies. He's been to see us many times whenever we're in Canada, and we're always trying to get the spotlights on him if we can, and he takes a bow, and I think he really enjoys it. But this time, he's going to give a talk. I'm told, a candlelit concert in St. Albans Cathedral. So what most beautiful building. I've sung there before, and that's on the Saturday night. I think Soren Koch, who is the bass player in the Zombies, is doing a Sunday lunchtime acoustic concert, and there'll be a meal with that. And then Sunday night, Steve Rodford will play. He has a band, a local band. Steve Rodford, the drummer in the Zombies, will play Sunday night. On the first night, there's going to be a 60s party where everyone gets together. All the original Zombies will be there at some point over the weekend. some of the guys have got to sort of look after themselves a bit. I don't think they'll be there for the whole weekend, but they'll do their best. I'll try and be there for the whole weekend if I can.
Great. That sounds very exciting.
It's really good fun. The other thing is that St. Albans, it's not where we all lived. It's where we all went to school. That's how the band got together. It's a very beautiful, it is a city, a very small city. And it was a Roman city. So its Roman name was Verulanium. And it eventually became St. Albans because the first Christian martyr was called St. Alban. And unfortunately, he met his end in St. Albans, and that's how it got its name. So they got rid of Verulanium and introduced St. Alban. It's a bit of a painful exercise for St. Alban, I'm afraid. Yeah. But it is a very beautiful city, and it's just nice to walk around. There's Roman ruins, Roman walls. There's this wonderful, huge cathedral, which has got the longest, is it aisle, the apse or something, the path that goes right down the middle of the cathedral. I don't know what you would call that, but there's a specific name for it. That's the longest one in the UK. And it's got a lot of history. You know, it's walking around the cathedrals enough to justify a weekend in St. Albans just on its own.
Yeah. Well, so last year, we spoke around the time that this documentary, Hung Up on a Dream, was in theaters over here in the UK. It was directed by Robert Schwartzman. I'm thinking that now it is available streaming in the US. It's like Apple TV, Amazon Prime. Is there anything else going on with the film or any more showings that you're aware of?
Well, I can't give you the, not because it's a secret, but it is up for an award, actually. I've got pages of notes here. If you'd asked me many other questions, I could have gone into huge detail. But on this particular question, I can't remember the name. It's an award that's only available for independent productions. And so we'll see what happens. It would be great. I think that Robert Schwartzman did a great job. It was always going to be a challenge because people didn't film in the 60s like they do now. There's a huge lack of film or video. But I think he managed to make a really interesting documentary about the zombies, even though there was only limited film of that time.
I want to point out, when you were referencing the performance in the Philippines, that's presented there in the documentary, and it's an incredible segment. Like, all of a sudden, you guys are being flown to the Philippines, and it was kind of like a residency. You were playing a number of shows there.
That's right. We played 10 nights in the Araneta Coliseum. I've been back since. It's different now. That it's much more plush now, so the figures have come down. I think you only get about 15,000 in there now. But when we played, we opened to 28,000, as I told you. We did a matinee of 15,000 on the Saturday. Saturday night was 32,000 people. And it went on like that for 10 days. And the amusing thing is that we were getting £80 a night between us. So we were, you know, we had a manager who either was a bit naughty or else wasn't very shrewd, to say the least. So if you work out 80 between five of us, it's just over £10 each, and you're playing to 30,000 people. Even we knew that was wrong, as naive as we were. And we did actually finish with that manager after that particular tour.
I want to return to the song that you mentioned. Rod had written a new song, and you're going to be continue working with him on that. Is that to be something for a future solo project of yours, or is there any chance that he would play on a recording with you?
I'm not sure what's going to happen because I'm recording a solo album anyway. Right now, we've started 8 tracks. We know what the other 2 tracks are going to be, but although we haven't started them, so that's a kind of a separate issue. I think the thing is to just record some of Rod's songs and wait for a path to present itself. I'm not quite sure. Maybe it could be a Zombies album, or maybe it'll be a Rod Argent album, or maybe it's a Rod Argent and Colin Johnstone album. But I'm up for it, whatever it is. So
well I am too. Yes. I'm ready.
Well, that's two copies we've sold.
Well, I'll buy a couple more and hand them out. That sound like excellent Christmas gifts and such.
Yeah.
Well, we can listen to another track off of the debut album right now. Begin Here, and I'd like us to hear one of the Chris White tunes, What More Can I Do? And it packs, it's a short song, about a minute and a half, but it packs a lot in there. You know, there's both a raucous organ solo, a raucous guitar solo. You're hitting some high notes in there. A lot of cool oohs going on. I know it was quite some time ago. Do you recall anything about that song when you were in the studio?
Well, the main thing I've always thought about this song is that it's very wordy. And it was a real challenge to get those words.
I'm happy to hear you say that. You know why? Because I went online to Facebook and there was these clips about Begin Here, and Chris White was talking not about What More Can I Do, but I Can't Make Up My Mind. And in that segment, he says, there's this thing about Colin where he always thought that I was packing too many syllables in a phrase.
I wouldn't be quite as black and white as that. I just I felt it was a little bit of a challenge. I was actually trying it this afternoon. Maybe your listeners would like to try it. If you do, what can I do? Oh, that's that one. And what's this one called? You're going to play this, the other one.
The one we're going to do is What More Can I Do? What more can I do now? Well,
that was what I just sang, wasn't it?
Yes, that's what you're just saying, yeah.
It's a lot of words to get into a first line. Well, what can I do? I just found it quite tough to sing that and make it, sound musical.
Yes,
but, yeah. It's probably not a criticism of Chris's songs. Probably a criticism of my singing technique, you know?
When he's talking about the... observation of yours. I mean, he's like, yeah, well, he's probably onto something there, but he always sings it so well that...
Yeah, that's very nice of him. Yeah.
Yeah.
We sorted it out in the end. We got there in the end.
Oh, it sounds killer. And we're going to take a listen to it in a moment. But Colin, first, once again, let me thank you for making our Coolest Conversations so very extra special cool.
Manfred, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. I've really enjoyed having a chat, and hopefully we'll meet up soon.
I hope so. And now it's What More Can I Do from the Zombies off the debut album Begin Here in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
What am I gonna do? You know I gladly allude myself to you. Stops me from loving you the way it should be. What am I gonna do? I'm trying hard, I know I could believe in you, but something always keeps a hold on.
What More Can I Do Now from the Zombies in Little Steven's Underground Garage? Yes, that one's off their remastered debut album, Begin Here. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to lead singer Colin Blunstone for making today's Coolest Conversation so special. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza and Kurt Baker for producing our podcast. Detroit area singer-songwriter Nick Punti, he's well known on the power pop scene, and his latest album is titled Solo-ish and out on Gem Records. Nick joins us next time around to tell us all about the release on your Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.